Okay, so one of the other things that happened there was that we had a very wonderful program in the city of Oxford. And of course, Oxford is very famous for its university. And so many students are there. And this program is held in Oxford Town Hall. And Prabhupada is very, very happy with this program. You might have seen some photos that identify where this place is. There's a huge organ with all the pipes. And Mukunda is sitting at the keyboard and he's playing while Prabhupada is dancing. Because that evening he got so enthusiastic. And instead of normally just sitting in one place on a cushion, he got off the cushion and he danced with all of us. And every seat was taken in that hall. And Prabhupada spoke how it is a duty of all students to become leaders. In fact, he said that many of these students from Oxford University will end up becoming leaders of big countries, powerful countries. And it's interesting because at that time, Bill Clinton was studying at Oxford University. He was a Rhodes Scholar. And of course, he ended up becoming the President of the United States of America. So, actually, Prabhupada said that there should be a temple in London for the mass of people, and the second temple in the UK should be in Oxford for the class. One for the mass, one for the class. So we arrived back quite late. It was about 10:30, 11 o'clock. And, but it just so happened that same evening, we had another program to attend in a nightclub called the Revolution Club in Mayfair. So Prabhupada noticed that we were preparing to leave. We weren't preparing to take rest. And he asked, "Where are you going? What's happening?" So we told him that, we have to perform at this nightclub. And Prabhupada asked, "Well, what happens at that nightclub?" And so Mukunda, he said that, well, everyone has a dinner. They have their dinner. And they drink a lot of champagne. And we're the entertainment for tonight. Because that's what they do. They have in clubs, they have entertainment. So he said, "We're going to dance the Swami. Teach everybody there how to dance the Swami. Just raise your hands up in the air. And you put one foot in front of the other and sway back and forth. Like you're doing kirtan. And we chant Hare Krishna." And when Prabhupada heard the description of what actually takes place there, because obviously couples, they go together, they drink, they have their non-vegetarian meal, he said, "It sounds like you're going to hell." He said, "But, you know, a devotee can go anywhere, even to hell, to preach." He says, "But just make sure you don't stay there. You have to come immediately back. Once you've finished your preaching, you immediately leave and come back." And Prabhupada was also very concerned about the time it was taking to finish the temple construction, as I told you earlier, if you recall, in the afternoon. The Shamsundar was a carpenter by profession, and he was working on constructing a temple roof in Buri Place on the ground floor. So Prabhupada was actually very anxious to be back in London. He didn't like particularly being so far away from the actual London temple. So in the beginning of November, Mukunda rented a one-bedroom furnished apartment in this big apartment building, very close to Regent's Park, just across the street from the planetarium. In London, there's one big road called Marylebone Road. Marylebone Road crosses Baker Street. So, and Marylebone Road is Madame Tussauds. You know what that is? Madame Tussauds. Where they have wax images. Wax images of very famous people. You never heard of that, Madame Tussauds? Next to Madame Tussauds, there's one in Amsterdam and Dam Square. And it's like a very theatrical thing. Like some very famous politician or famous singer or famous movie actor. They make and wax. And very lifelike. You'd almost expect the, you know, that wax, you know, face to move or to speak or to do something. Just like the Barack Obama, president of the United States. And David Beckham. So many different people like that. Famous sports people too. And next to there was the, what's known as the planetarium. So it's a very, very good location and not very far from very place. So, Purushottam, Prabhupada's servant, was very anxious to see on television the depiction of the moon landing. You know about that? The moon landing in 1969? Where someone called Mr. Neil Armstrong made a statement, one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind. The eagle has landed. Right? So they were supposed to have been shot into space from Cape Canaveral and landed on the moon. So the reason I'm telling you this is because that particular day that this arrangement had been made by Purushottam, he also acquired a television to watch this program. It was my day to massage Srila Prabhupada. So Prabhupada would take his massage normally in the front living room. And I'll just describe you, if you can try to see in your mind's eye what this apartment looked like. So there was obviously the front door. This is on the first floor of the building. So Prabhupada didn't have to walk up too many flights of stairs. So at the front door there was a little hatch, and that was the place where the milk was put. The milkman would deliver the milk in milk glass bottles. And so he would open this little door to this little hatch and put 2 pints of milk in that little box. And there was another door on the other inside. So in there was a hall, and across from the hall was the kitchen. To the left of the kitchen was Prabhupada's bedroom and bathroom. And to the right of the kitchen was the living room. And in the living room, because it was fully furnished, there was a carpet, there was a piece of furniture, there was what we call a cocktail cabinet with a rolling door shutter. It wasn't just open like this. You rolled it, you know, it rolled. Just little pieces of wood, slats of wood. And Prabhupada at that time had his own personal Radha Krishna deities. So when Prabhupada would have his massage, he would sit in the middle of the living room on the carpet, and the doors to the cocktail cabinet were closed because he was sitting just in his gumcha. He didn't want to appear like that in front of his deities. But that particular day, the television set was in the middle of the room. It was a big screen television for those days, 1969. But it was black and white. And Prabhupada had kept the doors to the cocktail cabinet open because he wanted his deities to also see the program. And so he was sitting along the same wall. And it was very awkward because where he was sitting was off the carpet on the wooden floorboards, very close to the wall. And I had to squeeze behind Srila Prabhupada. Because obviously he wanted to see the television also, and I had to massage him from behind. But it was very close to the door, and there was a big lampstand there too. And Malati, she was cooking for Prabhupada's deities that day, the noon offering. So, my only business there was not to watch television, not to get into any debate about whether man had landed on the moon or not. It was just to massage Srila Prabhupada as normal. So, but of course, there was a conversation going on, and I was overhearing the conversation. So, Purushottam switched on the television, and Prabhupada asked, "So, what is happening?" And at that particular moment, there was a very famous American broadcaster called Walter Cronkite, and he was reporting for, I think it was CBS, and so he was in the control room at Cape Canaveral with all the scientists and all the people that were busy, you know, tuning dials and doing whatever they do with computers, and communicating with the astronauts. So he was giving a running commentary, and he was saying, "Well, we're all very anxious to hear from Neil Armstrong, but we've been told that as soon as they land on the moon, that the cameras will start rolling and will be fed live pictures from the surface of the moon." So I was just there behind Prabhupada, massaging Prabhupada's head, as usual. And obviously, but still, I was, you know, facing the same direction as Prabhupada. I could also see what was happening on the television. So, finally, the cameras start to operate. And they start panning the surface. And so Prabhupada is asking Krishna what's going on. And he was saying, "Well, they've landed inside a crater." And Prabhupada says, "What can you see?" And they said, "Well, there's no water on the moon, and there's no air. It's very, very dry. And there's just some pebbles, some rocks, and some sand." So then Prabhupada asks inquiringly, "You can't see any buildings? There's no people? There's no gardens? There's no trees? There's no birds?" And Purushottam said, "Well, Prabhupada, these are live pictures from the surface of the moon. There's absolutely nothing there. There's nothing to sustain life." So then Prabhupada said, "Oh, if that is the case, then this is not the moon. You have not landed on the moon." He said, "According to Vedic astronomy, the moon is an upper heavenly planet, full of variegatedness." And then he went into a description of what, you know, we should expect to see on the moon. And Purushottam starts to question Prabhupada, "But that's not possible. How can the moon maintain any kind of life form if there's no oxygen and there's no water? Because these are necessities for life." And then Prabhupada says, "Well, I'm just going according to what we understand from Vedic astronomy. So I can conclude that they have not landed on the moon." So then there was a very heated debate between Purushottam and Prabhupada, and I kept thinking, well, he's asking for trouble. He really is, you know, he's skating on thin ice here. And as I was thinking like that, Prabhupada, he tells me, come and sit here. He wipes his hand on the floor. And he tells me to come around and sit in front of him, which he'd never done before, ever, while I was massaging his head. So I couldn't understand fully, but anyway, I had to follow his instructions. So I moved around and placed myself in front of him, facing him. And before I put my hands in Prabhupada's head, he put his hands in my head. He started rubbing my head really hard. And all he said was, like this, you have to massage like this. And I was seeing stars, and I was just thinking, wow, this is wrong, this is completely wrong, this has never happened before. Why is Prabhupada massaging my head? I'm supposed to be massaging his head. And I feel devastated, because obviously I'm doing something completely wrong. And then I asked him, I said, Prabhupada, should I sit here? And Prabhupada said, then how can I see the television? Go behind. So I actually went behind and started massaging. And all of a sudden, as I mentioned, Malati's in the kitchen, cooking for the deities. And he calls Malati. Calls it her name very loudly. He says, Malati, come here. And I thought, this is really becoming very dramatic. What's going on? I had no idea why Prabhupada called Malati. So she comes rushing out of the kitchen and comes down to Prabhupada's level with her hands like this and pays her obeisances. She says, Srila Prabhupada, what's happened? What's happened? And all he says to her is, you did not understand what you're doing? You did not understand? And she had no idea what Prabhupada meant. And Prabhupada was very, very expert at saying things in such a way that it remained in your brain for years and years and years. He said, how I can train you if you're not following my instructions. How can I train you if you're not following my instructions? And still, she could not understand what Prabhupada meant. What had happened was, besides, you know, the argument that was going on between Purushottam and Prabhupada, and then all of a sudden, because Prabhupada understood I was being distracted, and he was, you know, instructing me to massage him properly by massaging my head, giving a direct taste of what I should be doing. Out of the corner of Prabhupada's eye, through the door, it wasn't open, it was just slightly open, he saw Malati do something which he should not have done. And that is, she took the milk bottles from that little box that was the hatch next to the front door, and she had placed those dirty milk bottles on the deity's offering tray. It was like a little table about this size, just outside the front door, but by the side of the kitchen door. And the deity's offering tray was on that. So instead of normally taking the bottles and taking them into the kitchen and washing them, and pouring out the milk to boil it, she thoughtlessly took the bottles from the hatch and placed them on a deity's offering tray. So Prabhupada could understand that she wasn't learning from him how to be suci or brahminical. So she got chastised, I got chastised, and Prabhupada was chastising Purushottam like anything. So I thought, oh, it can't get any worse than this. I mean, this is just, you know, as bad as it can get. And I thought, I'm just going to concentrate on massaging Prabhupada's head. I'm going to try to close my ears. And I was just massaging Prabhupada, and Prabhupada was being very strong about the point that this is a big cheating process that's going on. And he was trying to convince Purushottam that the American government, the US government, was actually cheating the whole world into believing they'd landed on the moon. And again, Prabhupada wiped his hand on the wooden floorboards. He said, come and sit here, come and sit here. And I came around again and I thought, well, alright, this time Prabhupada certainly doesn't want to watch the television any longer. He wants me to sit in front. Because he's understanding and feeling very angry. Because I was up against the wall. I was feeling, you know, very claustrophobic. I felt like I couldn't do my service properly. And again, he puts his hand in my head. Starts massaging. Twice he did that. Not just the one time, but twice. And he just kept saying, like this. And again, I felt like I wanted to just disappear in between the cracks in the floorboards. Like, I don't want to be part of this any longer. But again, he motioned us, go to the back. So I went there, and it was, this time I had my eyes closed, and my ears were closed. At least I was trying, and just massaging, just concentrating, massaging Prabhupada. And Prabhupada just said, still you're not doing it correctly. I said, Srila Prabhupada, I'm trying my hardest. I'm not getting involved. I just want to please you. I don't want to hear anything more that's going on in this room. I just want to do my service. And they just left. I said, all right, continue. And the effect was that Purushottam, you know, we talk about the mad elephant offense. Sometimes that's mentioned in classics. So Purushottam had committed this mad elephant offense of completely disbelieving anything that Prabhupada was saying. And because of that, although he stayed with Srila Prabhupada up until the return to America, that was on the 21st of December, 1969. As soon as they landed in Boston, he had to leave. He couldn't stay. He said, I'm sorry, Prabhupada. I have to leave your service now. Please forgive me. And Prabhupada actually said, what have I done? And this was all to do with him taking the side of the astronauts. The so-called astronauts, that he couldn't accept any longer that Prabhupada was the spiritual master. He had taken on the NASA as being the guru. He had substituted NASA for Srila Prabhupada.
Amazing, Prabhupada actually saw that immediately. Now it's coming out of so many conspiracy theories. Prabhupada saw it immediately like that.
Well, he, of course, elaborated, especially when he started translating the fifth canto of the Srimad Bhagavatam, because there's so many descriptions of all the different planets that exist within this universe. And he talks about the moon, and also, of course, in 1975, when he was in Vrindavan translating the fifth canto, he brought to Srup Damodar, at that time he was still a brahmachari, but he was the head of the Bhaktivedanta Institute, BI. And on a morning walk, he revived this particular theme about the moon. He said, actually, if these astronauts had actually gone to the moon, then they must have traveled past the sun. Because he made an amazing statement. He said that the moon is twice as far from the earth as the sun. It's beyond the sun. And it's actually bigger than the sun also. And he also said that the moon is self-effulgent. So the moon is not deriving the light you see in the sky from the sun. But he said that, and this is also there in the fifth canto, I don't know if you've read that fifth canto. But there's a certain type of grass that grows there, and it's on fire. And that fire is not heating, but it's a cooling fire, which we have no experience of. So Prabhupada actually tried to encourage Swarup Damodar to mention these things to the scientists. That the moon is beyond the sun, it's bigger than the sun, and that it's giving off cooling rays of light. And that's the fact. You know, if you're ever in India, in the middle of the summer, in the hot season, and you're out on a full moon night, you feel the cooling rays of the moon. Isn't it? It's not heating rays, it's cooling rays.
There's one back when the Bodhi named Bhakta Joseph that was here. He just left a few days ago to go to Switzerland. And he heard this from a devotee, how the moon is larger than the sun. He's been working as a businessman his whole life, right? And then he comes to the devotional service, he's like 50, in his 50s.
Mm-hmm.
So then this new bhakta, he was telling him these things, just, you know, learning it out without, you know, kind of thinking about what he was saying. So it is kind of a crazy thing to hear after. I mean, it's the bhakta, but still, it's like after a whole life of non-devotional activities, and then, you know, you're depending on the scientists for your knowledge. Then you hear these things, like, just said blatantly. And then he was like, do you actually believe these things? How do you believe? But here we see Prabhupada speaking with complete authority and complete conviction, without a trace of, you know, I don't know how.
No doubt, absolutely no doubt. Because Prabhupada is actually quoting the Vedas, and Veda means all knowledge. And that's perfect knowledge. It's not empirical knowledge. It's not speculative knowledge. It's pure knowledge coming from a pure source. But naturally, if you discuss these things with a non-devotional person who can't understand the cultural purity of the Vedas, this is beyond his wildest dreams of imagination. Because we're spoon-fed so many different so-called facts about the nature of this cosmic manifestation. So then if you doubt those things, then you doubt the existence of Lord Brahma, the existence of Lord Shiva, the existence of Lord Vishnu. It's just all mythology. Isn't it? It just becomes like that. It becomes, how can any of it be true? How can these pictures that we see in front of the Bhagavatam and the dust cover, how is that existing? How is there such a place? Like it's in the form of a lotus flower. And that there's such a person as Radha Krishna engaging in eternal pastimes in that place, surrounded by so many Vaikuntha lokas. This is just all mythology. But the thing is that Prabhupada, because he's coming in the line of the Siddhic succession, is purely giving us this message directly, with nothing added and nothing subtracted. Then if we say with conviction, and also saying those things at the proper time, not just, you know, brandishing some information, just like, well, I know this, but you don't know this, so I'm an authority and you have to... No, that's, in some ways, that's kind of like a form of fanaticism. Because, you know, the way that the message is delivered is also very significant. It's like Krishna delivered the message of Bhagavad Gita to Arjuna in such a way that he was convinced that he should pick up his bow and arrows and fight. Otherwise it was done in a sentimental way, it wasn't done in a very, you know, philosophical way, where the Krishna explains to Arjuna his real purpose then Arjuna would have not much, to go on, to actually become resolved in his function as a kshatriya. But, Krishna explained very succinctly how he should perform his prescribed duty. So in the same way, if we want to deliver the message of the Bhagavatam, then we also have to be qualified.
Perhaps just came to me at one point that acharyas also, they can perceive. So I just take the Shastra, but it's like that they can actually realize it. If they see in Shastra that it is written, and they accept that, and they actually can realize that actually on the moon, with their own, I don't know how, but the acharyas can do that. I don't know if it's true, but I heard a story about Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati. He was watching the moon and he said something is going on. The influence of Kali Yuga is also visible on the moon.
Well, Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Goswami Maharaj was a very, very renowned astronomer and astrologer. That's why he got the name Siddhanta. Because he knew the Surya Siddhanta, he knew the actual astrological calculations. But he gave all those things up because he wanted to pursue pure bhakti. But he was a tremendous authority on Vedic astrology. The thing is too that actually if we really want to fully understand all this information in its pure form, that we also have to be, besides studying, we also have to practice. We have to follow the four corrective principles, we have to chant minimum 16 rounds, and then we actually are able to acquire finer brain tissues that we can actually perceive this is the truth, this is the absolute truth. The absolute truth covers not just the spiritual realm, but also the entire material realm too. Otherwise, we are prone to deception by these Hubble telescope sightings, by all the other astronomical devices that so many of these scientists use. You just have to look at the History Channel. And there's all this nonsense that's being poured out constantly, 24 hours a day. Because they're all tied up into thinking that they know the real way how to understand the cosmos. And they have their gurus. They have their own, they have their own line of disciplic succession coming all the way from Copernicus and Galileo. Because they shifted, they said that the earth isn't the center of the universe, the sun is. But we know the sun is moving constantly. They said, no, the sun is, is not moving, it's stationary, and all the planets are moving. In those days, in the 1600s, early 1600s, the church, especially the Catholic Church, their whole scientific learning was based on the fact that the earth is the center of the universe, that the earth is stationary, and the moon is, and the sun is moving, along with all the other, geocentric. We asked Prabhupada about the earth. Does the earth move? And he said that the earth moves like that. It's like if you study a mango tree and a slight breeze comes and the mango fruits, they move slightly along with the breeze. Otherwise the earth is fixed and the sun is moving. And of course there's all description what is powering the sun? That there's a person called Aruna, and there's a chariot. Just like if you go to Orissa, there's a very famous temple called the Konark. In Konark, it's a sun temple. It's a World Heritage Site. And one of the things that's depicted there, it's a sun temple. It's a temple dedicated to the sun god, Vibhishwan. And the chariot wheels are, you know, there. On the side of the temple building.
See, there's a magnet or something. Of course, there's
There was a magnet there, yeah. I think that's been removed. And that magnet was so powerful that any ships that were passing, and they had their compasses, they would get wrong readings because the compass was attracted to the magnet in the sun temple, in the roof of the sun temple. I've been there, I've seen. Have you been to Konark? It's a very interesting depiction.
After this vision, did Sri Prabhupada go back to a different concept of audience, different ways? Because in one of his lectures, Dutta Karma Prabhupada mentioned that Sri Prabhupada referred to this incident in three different ways. First, he would often amongst devotees say, it's bogus, it's kind of, it's, he would deny. Possibility of landing in the moon. And then one was of he would tell that, okay, they gone to moon, then what they have got, just they brought some stones. Third, he would say that gone to moon, but if someone wants to enter, if some spaceship wants to enter your place, if you don't want a spaceship to enter your country, then you can divert it somewhere else. So inhabitant to the moon, they might have diverted this fish like that. So did Srila Prabhupada consider the audience and then spoke accordingly?
No, what Dritta Karma has said is actually true. One time Prabhupada was asked, well, where did those astronauts land? They must have landed somewhere. He said, well, if they were able to break free from the Earth's gravitational pull, they may have landed on Rahu. Just like at the Konark Sun Temple, the planets are there, and there's Rahu and Ketu. And these planets are not known by those astronomers. They never quote these, they don't know about those two planets. But he also said that in an interview in 1968, this is in April, in La Cienega Boulevard, that's before the devotees shifted to La Cienega Avenue in Los Angeles, this radio interviewer was stressing this point about, you know, now the NASA has got sophisticated rockets, and the astronauts have sophisticated spacesuits. So why can't they enter into that atmosphere? Prabhupada said, they're not going to be allowed. He says, just like, if I come to your country without the proper visa, will you allow me in? No. I have to have the proper visa. I have to have the proper letter of introduction. I have to have the real reason for coming. So, similarly, that the moon is an upper heavenly planet. And if you're not qualified to enter into that atmosphere, you will certainly be prohibited. Even if you put on your fanciest spacesuit. Because you're not actually able to appreciate that particular atmosphere. Just like you would say about the Russians, when the cosmonauts went up for the first time, and they were circling the Earth, and they're always saying, oh look, there's my Moscow, there's my Moscow. So all the time they're thinking, I really want to be down there, what am I doing up here? I'm not getting any relief from being up here. So if you're not fully qualified, and Prabhupada said, of course, according to the book you wrote, Easy Journey to Other Planets, if you practice Astanga Yoga properly, and you see that depiction of that yogi who is able to elevate his soul from his heart through the, what's it called, the Brahmandra, from the top of the skull, and then the soul leaves that earthly body and acquires a moon body, then we'll be able to very comfortably exist there. Of course, you have to be qualified though, because it's an upper heavenly planet, and it's full of demigods. And one day there is equivalent to 6 months of earth time, and they live for 10,000 celestial years. And their bodies are also not subject to the same old age that we experience. As we get older, you know, then our organs don't function so well, our hair turns gray, we get more and more wrinkles on our forehead and by our eyes. Our teeth also become loose in the sockets, you know, because naturally old age has that effect on an earth body, but on a moon body, the person who's living there and enjoying the somaras and all the different material facilities available to them on that heavenly planet, they don't experience old age. They're always youthful, even though they live for 10,000 years. So, it's just a completely different atmosphere. But you have to abide by certain rules to be able to enter into that atmosphere. Just like even in the European Union. You know, if you don't have your proper visa, it's like, you know, Britain is not part of the Schengen Agreement, so you can get a visa for England, but you can't travel here on the same visa that you got for the UK. Right? Even during Rathayatra time, we had this nice devotee called Parasaram who came and prepared the prasadam for 5,000 down square. I don't know if you've seen our Amsterdam Rathayatra on YouTube. You can type in Amsterdam Rathayatra 2009, you can see all the film clips of all the different things that we did there. So he came over with one of his assistants from England, who was Russian, but he didn't have a visa for France, because Britain's not part of the Schengen Agreement. And so they immediately stopped at the border. No, you don't have a proper visa, you can't come in. So in the same way, if you want to go to the moon and you're not qualified, the authorities there will say, no, sorry, you can't enter. Even you may have a very, very, very costly spacesuit, which costs $500,000, and you've come in a big rocket that costs $20 billion. Sorry. We don't care. Get out of here. You're not allowed in.
Should consider the different audiences.
Yes. Yeah.
So Prabhupada believed he said the sun actually moves and the earth is stable.
Yes.
Just moves down.
Yes.
So there's no orbit or anything.
No.
So all the planets are still and only the sun is going around?
Yes. The sun, as we know, what does it do? It rises in the east and sets in the west. We even talk about that. We can see it. We can see the sun rising, and we can see it going up and up and down the other side. The sun always rises in the east and sets in the west, because the sun is moving. It's not stationary. So those religious people way back 500-600 years ago had it right. Because ultimately that knowledge came from the Vedas. It wasn't manufactured by some petty scientist with a little telescope, using imperfect senses and imperfect instruments. But we're led to believe, that's what I'm saying, that these present-day astronomers have their own parampara, Their gurus are Galileo and Copernicus. But we refute them and say, no, that's not true. We accept what the Vedas tell us. We don't accept what Galileo tells us or Copernicus tells us.
What if they show you, like, how they explain?
That's what I'm saying. You can become very bewildered. You know, you have a channel. It's called the History Channel, and it's also, of course, National Geographic and Discovery and so many. They're all trying to lead you to believe that they have the key to the mysteries of the universe. But they don't. It's just speculation after speculation after speculation. But it's worded in such a way that it's cloaked in words of wisdom. So-called wisdom. Cloaked in words of so-called wisdom. And you think, yeah, well, maybe they're right and the Vedas are wrong. But then if you start to think like that, then again, then why should you believe anything that's in the Vedas? Because it's a whole set of different circumstances. It's coming in a line of true disciplic succession. Asita, Devala, Narad, Vyasa. They're all great scientists in their own right. So that knowledge is transcendental knowledge, it's not mundane material knowledge. Because that's what's binding us, this material, is all this nonsense material, mundane information that we're being bombarded by TV, by the press, by, you know, so many huge expenditures which are being manipulated by these scientists. They're big cheaters. They don't want people to realize that they're cheaters, just like hidden archaeology. So all these different evidences of human civilization, human beings being present on this planet for billions of years. But will the anthropologists or the archaeologists, will they accept that? Of course they can't. Because then they won't get all their grants, they won't get all their power that they have in the palm of their hand will be taken away. They'll be exposed for being rascals. We're not telling the truth. So they hide all that information that doesn't fit into their particular picture of life and how human beings evolved. I mean, all these anthropologists, they all absolutely, totally are convinced that man is descended from monkeys or apes. They say that our ancestors are apes or monkeys. And we all came from Africa. What a nonsense. Absolute nonsense. And that, you know, from Africa, all the nations came. All the Europeans, the Indians, the Indonesians, South Americans. I mean, you think about it, it's totally illogical. But you talk to any of them and they'll say the same, they have their party piece, or their party line that they stick to. Well, they have to. Because if they start contradicting each other, then the whole thing just falls apart. But, you know, devotees, if we're gifted enough, we should expose these rascals for what they are. They are rascals. Because they don't accept the Vedas. They don't accept Krishna as being the supreme authority. They want to be the supreme authority. They want to be given the recognition and the huge grants they get from different governments to carry on their nonsense research. We know who the great. We're actually all coming from Lord Brahma. And where does Lord Brahma come from? He comes from Krishna. So ultimately, we can trace our ancestry all the way back to Krishna. Because we're parts and parcels of Krishna. But if you think that you've evolved from a monkey, alright, this is what Prabhupada said about Darwin. If Darwin is happy that he's coming from a monkey, let him be a monkey. No. Even, you know, during the time of Stalin in Russia, there was one doctor trying to create a race of half human, half ape people. And he had some willing human females who were ready to mate with monkeys, produce a mixture of ape and human, so that they would become fighters or warriors that could be controlled. And of course the whole experiment failed. Humans can't mate with monkeys and have children. Not possible. There are some mixtures, of course, just like you have what's called a mule. You know what a mule is? It's part donkey, part horse, but they can't have babies. And then they've also tried to mix zebras with lions, horses, or lions with tigers. And they got ligons, or tigons, I'm not sure what they call them. There's certain species that you can almost get away with, but there's no way a human being can mate with a monkey and have children, offspring.
That's not possible, that's cheating, because they said from the monkeys it evolved to human, not by mixture of human and the monkey.
But just see how demoniac people are. Very demoniac. Because they want to play God. They don't believe in God. They want to play God themselves. Because if you deny God, He's the supreme control and the supreme origin of everything, then what role does the scientist have? Well, it's just a subservient role. But they don't want to be subservient to anybody. They want to be the big controllers. And that's why Prabhupada set up the Bhaktivedanta Institute, to explore this. And to also establish the scientific fact that life comes from life. Life does not come from the Big Bang. Recently there was a Big Bang in Baghdad, killed 162 people. Two Big Bangs. So we know that Big Bangs destroy life, they don't create life. So how can you accept the Big Bang theory of the scientists? It's creating, I mean, that's, again, it's just absolutely ridiculous. Otherwise, we should be happy all the time that big bangs are going off. There's so much life is being produced, but we know that all you get from a big bang is just suffering and death and destruction. Isn't it?
No, you get it, just the coincidence, like just happen. There is no plan behind it.
Just by chance. By chance. By accident. We're all big accidents. All of us are just accidentally here.
It's so complex, worms that they cannot reproduce. Even if they have the materials for that, then, you know, just accident. Just happen.
But let them create, in their laboratory, an orange. Simple fruit like an orange. Let them do that. But they can't. But yet they want to use all their intellectual power for speculating on what's out there. What is the sun? Of course there's no life from the sun. It's too hot for life. That's what they say. But we know that according to the Vedas, there's life in all planets. Not just cold planets or warm planets, but super hot planets also. There's life. Because Krishna spoke to Vibhishman, the sun god, who resides in the sun planet. Krishna's not going to lie. He's telling the truth. He is the truth. He's the absolute truth.
As our Anjima, if you are a master, if you have really like a master yoga, you know that, I and sound, you can actually, like how they produce gold, or
Ashtanga Yoga.
Yeah, Ashtanga Yoga. Actually, so with sound, vibration, you can, so maybe that's what they're trying to speak.
Well, look at Kardama Muni. What, if you read the Bhagavatam, what did Kardama Muni produce from his austerities, from his Ashtanga Yoga? A flying citadel, a huge city, for his wife, Devahuti. And this was a floating city of palaces, and gardens, and fountains, and so much amazing, arrangements. And this came from his potency because he was practicing Ashtanga Yoga for thousands and thousands of years. And not only that, but that flying palace, spaceship, for lack of a better word, could travel to any part of the universe at will. That's extraordinary. Again, it's beyond our imagination. It's beyond our realm of experience. But we study the Bhagavatam that Prabhupada has given us so that we can actually realize that these things can exist. The scientists will deny it and say, oh no, no, that's impossible. Because they can't do it themselves. That's all. Because it's beyond their realm of experience. And then they just deny it and say, no. But we don't do that. We accept. But we accept the proper authority, not some bogus authority. I think we're 6:30. Sangha. In the dialogue. You know where he stays?
Yeah.
Over in the guest house. Downstairs. On the right side or the left side?
Yes.
And then.
Right, side push.
Thank you so much.